Alrighty, everybody. Master Abbott here from CapsuleComputers.com. Today on the phone we have Keith Robinson from Intellivision Productions. Keith, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic as well. Keith, thank you for spending the time with us to talk on the phone today and talk about Intellivision, that's actually the truth. I wanted to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are today in the industry.
Okay. Well, I actually I had a background both in art and in computers back in the late 70s, and my real goal was to go into film effects, which I did. But one day, talking to some people about, I actually went to see where they were doing the movie Tron, at a place called Information International, III in Culver City, and they gave me a tour and showed me what they were doing on the movie Tron. And it made me curious about video games, so the following week when Mattel was doing a open house job fair type of thing, trying to hire programmers, I went over to take a look. They found out I had talked to the people who were doing Tron. They had licensed the movie Tron to do a video game, so they asked me to do the video game. So I kind of fell into it, and I worked at Mattel from 1981 to 1984, then the company that bought the rights from Mattel. I did their packaging. I didn't do any programming for them, but I did their packaging and their instruction books and their catalogs from 1985 until 1990.
Oh, that's amazing. So basically, continue going.
Yeah. So when the internet came about and the World Wide Web, I thought that'd be a great chance to put up a site about the history of Intellivision and who did what games, because Mattel never put credits on the games, or rarely did. And so I put a site up in 1995 and found out there were thousands and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out there who still were interested in Intellivision. So put together a little company. We bought the rights and started to release the games for new platforms, the PC, for the Mac, for PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, GameCube, Xbox, Xbox 360. So, and now we, this is the 30th anniversary of Intellivision. Intellivision was introduced nationally in 1980 in the United States. And then this year we're on iPhone, iPad, and now the Nintendo DS, which is our big product that we just released this month.
That's amazing. That's really, really good. You've probably answered a few questions of mine already, but what I'll do...
I warned you. You get me started on television, I'll keep talking all day. I just,
that's
like
good.
I say, I started in 1981. It's been my life. I just, I love these games. It's,
yeah, you've got a good passion.
And I love talking to the people about it. It's so funny now just to think that I'm getting up there in years now, and people come up to me and go, oh, yeah, I played this game when I was 6 years old under the Christmas tree, and that's what got me started in computers. And now I work for JPL Laboratories and NASA on the Mars landing. Oh, geez.
That's fantastic.
You know, it's like, great, fantastic. But don't blame me for that. But
you've been inspiration.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who say that the playing with the Intellivision was their first time they ever encountered a computer, that they ever actually worked with a computer, was playing Intellivision games under the Christmas tree when they were, you know, 10 years old.
You know, that's a funny thing. That's basically, if you want to call it, I was pretty much in that same boat. So that, I think we're all pretty much the same, all of us.
Yep.
All right, so next thing, which you've just said the word Intellivision. Now, there are a lot of people out there, you know, I know that you know, that have just started, new people, new gamers out there that probably would have no idea, of what Intellivision is. Could you give us a rundown of what kind of console that was? When it was basically made and stuff like that? And if you know, do you know how many actually units were sold at the time?
Oh, yeah. What happened is that, you know, this all really got started with the Pong game that Atari came out with. And back in the early 70s, everybody wanted their own Pong game at home. And then as things started to get a little more sophisticated, Atari came up with their Atari 2600, which actually had different cartridges and played different games. And so Mattel, at the time, was the largest toy company in the world, and they kind of said, gee, we should have something like that. And so they created the Intellivision system to compete with the Atari 2600. And it was also like the Atari 2600. It was a little, you know, microcomputer system with a cartridge-based games. Theirs was 6502-based processor. Ours was a General Instruments 1610 processor. And the big advantage of ours was a 16-bit processor, where theirs was 8-bit.
Wow.
People keep talking about the 8-bit era, but we were actually the first 16-bit one, which gave us an advantage in terms of, some of the gameplay, some of the graphics, and the sound effects and everything could be a little bit more sophisticated, so we could compete on that basis.
Mm.
The problem was we were twice the price of an Atari 2600.
Well, if you look at an 8 and 16, of course you got to be a bit more.
Yeah, well, the other thing is that when you think about it, at the time, so ours sold for $300 retail in the U.S. at the time, which is probably now the equivalent of like a $900 machine, about three or four times the price of Xbox 360 today or something like that.
Yeah, it is too.
So the fact that then of people making a commitment to play video games was really a big decision. So we're really happy that we got that that penetration into the market and everything. At the time, we were about 20% of the market.
Wow.
Which translated into about 3 million home units at the time. What's fun now is that with the things we've sold since then, since we've come back in the last 10 years, we've sold about 4 million of our products now for different things. So if you translate it to 3 million consoles back then and the 4 million now, there's like as many people playing in television today as we're playing back in the heyday of the 1980s.
That's amazing. Well done. You guys have done well.
Yeah. So the thing is with the Atari machines, it was far easier for other people to program for them. So what happened was that every company in the world practically decided, we need to be releasing Atari 2600 games too. So I don't even know if anybody's ever managed to do a full catalog of the games for the Atari 2600. For the Intellivision, there were 125. Most of them released by Mattel, but some released by other companies. Sega did one. Parker Brothers did some. Coleco, iMagic, Activision did some Intellivision games, but nothing near like the catalog of the 2600 games. But that's what killed the industry back in 1989. Was there were just so many games out there,
yeah,
that no one could keep track of which one were the good ones, which ones were the bad ones. A lot of bad games flooded the market, and the companies, Atari and Intellivision, that made the hardware weren't getting anything from that. Today, if you make a game for the Xbox, PlayStation, for Wii, you have to pay a licensing fee and the manufacturing to those companies.
Yes.
To Sony, to Microsoft, to Nintendo, to come out with games on those systems.
That's right.
So if you have a hit game, they are going to be able to participate in it also. Back then, we didn't. So the result was, as more and more stuff got out there, the manufacturers got less and less money.
Mm.
And in 1983, it killed the whole industry until Nintendo came up with this idea of, hey, why don't we get a share from all the games, not just the ones we make? That's the paradigm today for the market, and that's what's kind of keeping everybody in business today, is you have that. But in 1983, it just wiped out the market. People thought it was dead. Back in 1984... when Coleco, Atari, Mattel all got out of the video game industry, there was a time when they said, well, that's it, it's dead.
Yeah,
but
that's it.
The head of marketing for Intellivision at Mattel, he was the one guy, a guy named Terry Velusky, he was the one guy who said, despite all this glut and all these losses in the industry, the actual demand for video game has been going up. I don't think this is a fad.
Yeah, that's good.
So
yeah, that's right.
He bought the rights to Intellivision. In 1975, Intellivision was the only game you could still buy in the United States.
Amazing.
Before Nintendo came into the United States. And he kept it going. He kept it going. He proved to be correct that, it was kind of a fad back in the early 80s, but there was a core group of people who really wanted to make gaming, a regular hobby, a regular thing they were doing. And he was certainly correct.
That was the INV2, wasn't it?
What was
then being sold after the crash?
From our company?
From television.
Yeah. Well, the television, Mattel actually made a thing called the Intellivision 2, but the Intellivision 2 played the same games. It simply was a cheaper to manufacture unit. They made custom chips where they could combine chips and things like that. So there never really was a, unlike Atari that came out with the 5200, the 7600, whatever it was, that came out with improved units. Intellivision, Mattel never really did. So it's only been the Intellivision and the Intellivision 2. They did come out with a thing called the INTV System 3.
That's it.
And, but all of them play the same games.
Oh, okay. So those ones came out, but they were pretty much the same units all along.
Yeah, they were really just kind of redesigned the hardware, just kind of how they manufactured. So what happened was, at the beginning, they built it all with off-the-shelf parts.
Okay.
Then when they started making millions and millions of them, they said, hey, we can afford to make some custom chips so that the units are smaller or the units cost less. But then when it went back to just the new company, INTV, that bought the rights from Mattel, they couldn't afford to make millions and millions of them, so they went back to the off-the-shelf design. And then they call that the System 3, and it looks like the original one. So that's why there's all these different television units out there. They're just kind of, but they all play the same games.
Fair enough. That's good. What does the word Intellivision mean?
Well, it's just a contraction for intelligent television. the reason for that is that when Mattel wanted to compete against the Atari unit, since Mattel was kind of a family company and known for, you know, long time for games and everything, they thought that the way to compete with Atari was to present the Intellivision as the cornerstone of an entire computer system for the family. And they were going to come out with this really nice keyboard component that was a 6200, which is actually very much like an Apple II computer that would actually attach to your Intellivision and play very sophisticated games and a lot of educational games, family accounting, and all of this. And so that was the whole thing. And they wanted to really stress intelligent television because this was going to be the computer system that was really going to introduce your family to a computerized life. But when they actually started doing it and released the games, they found that really people just wanted arcade-style games in their homes. So
yes.
Very quickly, they kind of abandoned the idea of being this wonderful home computer system and just turned it into, you know, hey, we've got better graphics and Atari, play our games.
Yes, very good, very good.
The very first year, you saw the commercials showing you that, hey, this was going to be it was going to be everything for your home. But by the second year of Intellivision coming out, they were just doing the commercials saying, here's Atari baseball, here's Intellivision baseball, gee, our graphics are better, our games are better. So
yes.
So all the intelligent stuff kind of went out the window, but that's where it came
from. That's brilliant. So tell me, what was Intellivision's top five best-selling games from that 125 list of titles that were released?
Well, most of them, starting out with the big popular ones, the big sellers, they sold over a million apiece, were the sports games. And the reason for that is that when Mattel was trying to compete with Atari, the thing at the time was most people didn't know what a video game was. You had to go to an arcade or something to kind of say, oh, so the idea of putting on television for the masses, hey, we are a better video game company than Atari is, it was hard to say that or promote that. But everybody knows what a baseball diamond should look like. Everybody knows what a soccer field should look like. Everybody knows what a basketball court should look like. So when they would show the Atari game, and you wouldn't see that.
Yeah.
Say, here's Atari football, here's Atari basketball, here's Atari baseball, and then here's Intellivision. The Intellivision one looked more like a real sports game.
Mm.
So it was the sport that first really promoted Intellivision, because people could look at the two and say, hey, that one looks more like a real baseball diamond, I'm going to get that one.
Mm.
And so the sports things were the first thing that really pushed it. Those all sold a million. But then some of our other games, some of our arcade-style games, Astro Smash, which is kind of an Asteroids type of game, it sold over a million copies. We did the Dungeons & Dragons game that sold really well, sold over a million. So so the sports games first, but then some of the really arcade-style games did very well after that.
That's amazing. That's brilliant. Tell me, what is what's your favorite game or games? Games, favorite games on the Intellivision, and why?
Well, my favorite game, and it's very funny because it's probably one of the smallest games. It's actually, there's a cartridge called Triple Action. And the Triple Action cartridge has three games in it. So the games at the time were like 4K in size. So that game has got to be like less than 2K in the actual programming, which, you know, wouldn't even do a sound effect in a game today. So it's very, very small for this entire game. But it's a game called Biplanes. And
Biplanes.
It's a two-player game, and you just battle each other in a dogfight. But the guy who programmed it programmed in gravity and everything very realistically. So you can go up and you can stall and your plane can drop down and you can, then you kind of swoop underneath and do these rolls and shoot the other guy. And it's just brilliant. It's a two-player game. So you have to have two guys who are pretty good at it. But that's the game that when the programmers get together, we were just recently in Las Vegas for a show, and we had a television set up for demos. And that was the game that the programmers kept wanting to play, because that's one where you really, you know, have a really fun time. Now, I like playing Astro Smash. When I'm by myself, I probably play Astro Smash. The game that I was, like, I think back then most impressed by, we had a game called Treasure of Tarman. It was a Dungeons & Dragons game. And because of the licensing, we can't call it that anymore, but it's on our DS version now as Minotaur. But it is a really great Dungeons & Dragons type of game, and it's very impressive, very well done. And I really liked that game. The Night Stalker is a great game, which is just kind of a robots in a maze type of game.
Ah, yes.
There's just a lot of them that are really fun to play. But when I get somebody else together with another programmer, we put in Biplanes. What's really fun is our DS version that we just came out with. It takes advantage of the local wireless. So
really?
Somebody else has a DS, and it takes one cartridge. You put in the one cartridge,
and it works on both.
Works on both. You upload the game to the other one, and so you're both sitting there playing Biplanes, and it's just wonderful.
That's wonderful.
You can do all the loops and all the stalls and everything. It's just, like I say, it was such a simple game. The graphics are nothing. It's just the graphics are the most basic little, you know, here's a few pixels to make a biplane, and here's a little, you know, tower at the bottom. It's a little stick figure of a tower, and that's it. And it's just, but it's just so much fun. It really kind of shows that one of the things back then, you really didn't have a lot of graphics, a lot of sound effects and everything. So the programmers spent most of the time on the gameplay, just making sure the game was fun.
Yeah,
and today, you do a game, you've got so many graphics, so many assets that have to be locked into this that sometimes the gameplay can get a little bit lost in stuff.
That's true.
I think the games today are great. The fact that they can take advantage of that, of just the realism of things, is wonderful. But and a game that, you know, could take you 40 or 50 hours to play. But I tell you, every now and then, to play a little 3 or 4 minute game is just a lot of fun.
That's true. That's very, very true. Alrighty. Next thing I was going to ask you was a bit of a comparison test. The Intellivision, when I was around back in the days where I used to play these machines, I had all of them, which I was very lucky to have. But the one that was really confusing for me was the Intellivision looked very similar to the CBS ColecoVision. Now, what did the Intellivision have that was better than let's say, for example, the CBS ColecoVision, because that really had a really good graphic system as well, and the control systems were very similar too. What do you think made the Intellivision a little bit better than the CBS ColecoVision if it did?
Well, one of the problems, we were kind of victims of our own advertising, because when we were going up against Atari, we kept showing on television, hey, look, our graphics are better. Well, then the Coleco, which came out a couple years after ours did, their graphics were better. They came out. Theirs is based on the Z80 chip, and it could handle better graphics. Now, it did not have as good sound. The ColecoVision doesn't have as good sound. It doesn't have as good a sound chip. The sound chip that's in the Intellivision was used in a lot of arcade machines. Very good, nice little sound chip.
Okay.
So we had better sound than the Coleco did, and the Coleco had kind of the same problem with the Atari, which is how it handled its moving objects. It was kind of a multiplex system, so if you had more than two or three moving objects on the same line, they started to flicker, where ours did not.
Okay.
They had the advantage, they could put more moving objects on the screen than we could,
yes,
but we could put more in a line than they could. So so there's advantage of that. But it really comes down to, what are the games and what is the gameplay? Now, in the case of Intellivision, we had people developing games of all types. We had the sports games, we had the space games, we had the arcade games, and most of the games that we did were original games. Mattel did very little licensing. We did, we licensed Tron, but then we came up with original games based on the Tron movie. We did Burger Time, Lock and Chase, Bump and Jump, Mission X, Locomotion. It was about the extent of the arcade games that we did that were actually out in the world. Now, when Coleco came along, almost everything they did was arcade games.
Ah, okay.
Because that's how, in that day, that's how you got into the market. Once Atari and Intellivision was in there, how are you going to compete against them?
Yes.
Well, the only way you can really compete is like, well, we've got Donkey Kong. So they went out and bought Donkey Kong. Mm. They had Donkey Kong, Zaxxon.
Yes.
A lot of these big games were in the market that they did. You know, they did a couple sports games. They had an auto racing game, a baseball game, because everybody had something
Turbo.
Like that.
Turbo, yeah, I think that. Yeah.
And they have a Smurf game, I think.
Yes, they did. They did. I remember having that.
Yeah.
I still remember the song to that. That's good. No,
they had
right.
a problem with that game. The just a little side thing here.
Yeah, tell me.
When they first released the Smurf game,
yeah.
As I said, the problem with the ColecoVision, like the Atari 2600, is if you have too many moving objects in a line, they start to flicker.
Yes.
And so what would happen is on the Smurf game, at the very end, you would go and rescue this princess. Well, the princess's skirt was made out of one of the moving objects. And so if you got close at the very end of the game, if you got close to it, then press the duck button for your character to duck down, his hat then was on the same level. And because of the flickering, it made her dress disappear. So this became quite famous and talked about in a lot of magazines. So they actually changed the game so that when you got to the end, the duck button was disabled. So they made a running change. So later copies of it, you can't duck down your character.
You know what? I'm gonna go try that now because I've got the original cartridge at home. I've got it in the other. I've got it in the other room.
Find
I'm gonna try it out.
See if you have the disappearing dress one. Or
yes,
yeah,
I will. I'm gonna try it out as soon as we get off the phone. That's brilliant. Oh, but that's probably the first thing.
The thing is, so that to me is why the Intellivision system is still better than the ColecoVision. And the ColecoVision, that was the essential thing is they had very good arcade games. But that's if you're starting out with Mousetrap or Donkey Kong or whatever, mm-hmm. You're going to have some great games. You're going to spend millions and millions of dollars. That's why these companies were going out of business toward the end is they were just spending so much money they could never recover from the licensing they were buying.
Yeah,
and Parker Brothers, they got the they had the Star Wars license and they got James Bond license. This stuff cost millions of dollars back then.
Yeah, that's right.
They just couldn't compete with all the other games that were out there.
Yeah,
the Intellivision, so that for us was the big advantage when we got the rights to the Intellivision, is that most of the games don't have licenses.
Mm.
And this DS version that we've got now has got 60 games on it.
Wow.
Because there's 60 games that don't require licenses. We could not, because of the licensing, we could not include Burger Time or the Tron games, which we'd love to be able to do at some point.
Mm.
But there's 60 games on it. This is a product that is a relatively inexpensive product. It's one of the... because of the size of the games, we could fit all of these onto the smallest size cartridge. It's in the United States. The United States is a $15 product.
Brilliant.
Which is, half the price of other DS games out there.
Exactly.
And it's got 60 games on it. And we can do that because we don't have these licensing fees on there. I mean, if you do the Atari cartridge, you're going to have Pac-Man. Whoops, that's Namco. We got to license that.
Yeah, that's true.
If you have ColecoVision... If you got the ColecoVision, we got to get Donkey Kong in here. Whoops, that's Nintendo. Nintendo system.
That's
so
very true.
It allows us, see, from the beginning, we've had two advantages to owning the Intellivision. One is that the games are mostly non-licensed, so when we bought the rights, we got all these games free and clear. Second of all is that Mattel didn't call the system Mattelovision. Because Mattel is still going strong as a toy company, and so we can be out here and not compete with them, because unlike Atari and ColecoVision that named their systems after the company,
yes.
you know, we can still operate as a company here, as completely separate from Mattel, and not having to license their name or something like that. So So that's an advantage we have with the games and the name of the system. So so we were able to bring back these games and put them on all these different platforms, and it's just trivial. I mean, the iPhone version, the first game, Astro Smash, which was a million seller for us, a huge game, we give that away for free. You go and you download from the App Store the iPhone game, and you know, you can play Astro Smash for free. And then there's five more games on there that you pay, you know, just a nominal fee for to get those on there also. And on the iPad, it's just been so much fun getting these games out there for people to play them again. And the great thing is that it's not just nostalgia for people who played them then. New people are discovering them all the time.
That's good. That's basically what I was going to ask you as well. But another thing I was going to say was, what made you want to go in and buy the software licenses for Intellivision? You know, because you probably would have thought, you know, okay, it might be it'll get me somewhere, but you know, you're probably thinking, why would you want to buy the rights to this and create Intellivision productions and products? And what could you offer?
Well, the whole thing was that it really was a labor of love. What happened was, when we were working at Intellivision, they were so afraid of, and there was really competition out there, and all the companies were stealing programmers from each other.
Yes.
So because of that, Mattel didn't want anybody to know what the name of the programmers were.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was something we always, you know, we're all egomaniacs. You know?
Yeah.
So we wanted to get our name out there. So that was the first thing, was just to put up the credits for these games.
Yes.
On the web. That was the first thing. Strictly, that's all I initially intended to do, was let's put up the credits.
Yeah.
And so I did that, and that was the whole thing. But then the other thing that happened was, there was a woman who designed a lot of educational games back in the 1970s for some of the computer systems. They were, you know, for like the Atari 400 or for the Commodore 64, whatever. She did educational games, and she died. And Ernst Adams, who was a programmer, he was the first programmer on the Madden games, when it was part of Madden football games, was part of Activision, I believe.
Yes.
Anyway, Ernest Adams has been in the industry for years, and he did the eulogy for this woman when she died. And one of the things that she said that always stuck with me was, the sad thing is, you can't play any of her games anymore.
Oh.
All those systems she wrote for are dead.
Okay.
So this was a really, you know, sad thing. And this was like, you know, right around, I don't know, 1990 or so that he'd said that.
Mm.
Well, by 1995, really emulation was really starting to come into its own. Activision had released some of their games, and so when people started to, you know, when I put up the site about the credits, a lot of people started writing in saying, "Are you going to do something with emulation? Are we going to be able to play these games again on the PC?"
Yes.
And so we started looking at it. Wouldn't that be great? So that these games don't die, so that we always can play the games.
Mm.
So really, the whole idea was, can we make any money off of it? It was always like the third consideration. That was not the main thing. It was like, part of it was ego, and part of it was just, you know, having these games out there. So and having kind of an instructional thing. We got a very good review when we came out with our very first version on the PC. The LA Times recommended it simply because of that it was like a history lesson.
Ah.
You can play all these games, you also get to see where they came from, where this stuff comes from today.
That's brilliant.
See, when we started, none of us had ever, you know, we didn't grow up with them. These were programmed by people who did not grow up with video games.
That's what you want to see. That's perfect.
And we were kind of creating the language back then. See, now, when you create a game, there's certain things you put in there because there's certain things people expect to be in there.
Mm.
There's like a language of games. Well, we kind of helped create that language back then.
True.
You know, some people would say, oh, let's do the game this way. And some people say, oh, let's do it this way. Now, you kind of have to do it a certain way because people, and it's amazing to me. It's amazing when I see a kid pick up a game. I was in Clifton, New Jersey earlier this year. There's a shop there that was having I was in the neighborhood, and they found out I was going to be there, and they asked if I could come by, and they would do an Intellivision day in the shop and do the history and everything. And they had an Intellivision set up when I went there, the game Burger Time.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went there, and I played against a kid who probably was 12 years old and who had never seen it on television before.
Okay, good.
And I'm not kidding you. Within 10 minutes, he was beating me at that game.
And you play it all your life.
He just learned, and he just kind of knew. There was just kind of an innate sense of when the next power-up or the next bonus would come up on screen and just where to be for it and all of that. And he just got it. Just innately knew how these games were done. Well, that didn't exist back then.
Yeah.
Anybody who is like over 35, you know, probably didn't grow up. Anybody who's 35 or younger did grow up with this stuff. And or now I guess they're like 40s. I don't know where the line is. You know, it keeps changing. But anybody who's like less than 40 now probably can pick up a video game and get it and just get and can figure out, oh, I see, this is the power up, this is where they're, this is where they get a bonus life here, this, blah, blah. They can just see that.
Yeah.
And that, but that's part of a language that we helped create. It was really interesting. So just kind of listen to that. The idea that there would be money in it kind of, the first time I really thought that is back in 1998 when we first came out with this. I gave a copy of it to an editor of one of the newspapers around here.
Yeah.
And after Christmas, he came to me and said, oh, Keith, oh, God, my kids spent the entire Christmas holiday playing bowling. Bowling? You know, it's like, wait, your kids who are like 9 and 12 spent days playing a 1980s bowling game? But they were fascinating. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, at first they were kind of making fun of the graphics and everything, but then they kept wanting to come back. Oh, where's the game? I want to play the game again. Dad, can I play it? You know, it's like, when we came out with our plug-and-plays, I took one to a party. A friend of mine's kid was having a party, so I just took it along. It wasn't even released yet. I just wanted to get kind of a feedback. And the kids were fighting each other for who got to play it next. And so I started to realize that, you know, these kids have never seen it on television. They don't know anything about the old gaming systems and everything. But, you know, they get the games. They're fun. They get them. And they were having a great time. So then I started saying, you know, that's when we really started to say, there really is kind of a market for these. And we sold nearly 4 million of those plug-and-plays. We've sold 300,000 of the PlayStation 2 version around the world.
That's amazing.
And,
That's what I was going to ask you as well. So basically you've got them on the different consoles as well. So you've got, like, go ahead and continue one from there. So you've got them on consoles, different consoles and stuff like that. So run us through what the Intellivision or Intellivision Lives games are on.
Yeah, well, we first were on the PC and the Mac, and then we were on PlayStation 1 now, and then PlayStation 2, Xbox, and GameCube. Now, the problem there is that every time that these guys create the next generation of console, they... You know, we would love to be on all of them, but the problem is that, you know, they say, well, we don't really want those old games because the old games don't show off
the graphics,
the new things that we've got on here.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to do these, you know, the user interface. This little, you know, we created an arcade type of environment for the on the PlayStation 2 and Xbox versions, but now that they were selling very well and kind of perennial, because you figure, well, they never go out of style. But as soon as the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3 come out, now the stores, they don't want to put stuff on the shelf that says PlayStation 2 on it.
Ah, okay.
So now, in order to get in a box that says for PlayStation 3, they don't let us just take the old PlayStation 2 one and slap a PlayStation 3 label on it.
Oh, yeah.
We have to redesign the user interface again. So we can wind up spending tens of thousands of dollars on an interface for a game that should only cost a few thousand dollars to put together.
I get you, yeah.
So because it's like, okay, it's the same game, same emulation, but now we have to do even fancier stuff.
Yeah.
So and the other thing is also, and I hate to say this, but because I think everybody kind of likes playing these old games, they all seem to have fun with it,
yeah.
But the consoles aren't our primary audience, because the consoles you're going to be going for, you know, what, 15 to 24 year old males.
True.
But something like the DS has more of the demographics. It skews a little bit younger and older.
Yeah.
And so the DS is a perfect place for us to be. It's portable, so you're going to be playing it in locations where you want probably a shorter game.
Yeah.
And if you're familiar with the Intellivision that had the overlay system.
Yes.
The Intellivision had the system where the hand controllers had 12 buttons.
Down the bottom.
A 12-button keypad.
Yep.
And then it had a disc, and then it had side action buttons and everything. And there's never been a system since then with as many buttons on it as the Intellivision had.
Yeah.
So anytime we do emulation on one of the consoles, we have to find a way to kind of, you know, pop up something. And it's always a bit of a compromise. But
yeah.
The DS doesn't. The DS
it's got the top and the bottom.
The lower touch screen, we actually show the overlay from the original controller. So the DS is the closest thing to actually playing a real Intellivision again.
That's true.
And in some ways it's better because you don't lose the overlay. The overlay is attached permanently to the game.
That's true. And you got a good overlay. Screen on both sides.
Oh yeah. So it's so much fun to play it on the DS that, you know, I'm really happy with that. It's also good to play on the iPad and iPhone. It's the same type of thing. We can bring the buttons up on screen as a touch screen type of situation.
Yeah, that's good.
So I'm really excited that the technology is kind of catching up to the 1980 Intellivision now.
That's brilliant.
It's really better to play on these systems than to play on the PC, than to play on the the Xbox. Now the thing is though, the Xbox 360.
Yeah.
With the internet connection, they have put the Intellivision things into Game Room on Microsoft, so you can play there. What's exciting about that is, you know, they're nicely emulated games, and you play it. And then when you get the high score, the, you know, people in, you know, Finland can see
them.
You got the high score.
Who's got the high score?
They can play, and they can get the high score then. And then it's like, hey, this guy in Finland beats your score. You can let that stand?
So, that's exactly right.
You know,
it continues going
worldwide,
on. Yeah.
Yeah, you have this worldwide competition going on these games, which is really a lot of fun. I mean, that's just having that kind of worldwide competition on these games is just spectacular. So
yeah. I was going to ask you,
because
I was going to say, I know that you were talking about the games and what Intellivision is, but what the product that you guys have out at the moment is Intellivision Lives. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And
Intellivision
that,
Lives, that's... We just came up with that name in 1998, and it's kind of like stuck for all of our collections.
That's brilliant. And basically, that has, you said, roughly what, 60 titles? Is that every single version of a television that has about 60, or is it less or more?
The DS has probably the most of any of them, but the console ones have about the same number. Yeah, we always, the PC Mac, pretty much around the 60 games is always about where we are. Sometimes we'll include some of the unreleased games, sometimes we won't. The DS has several of the it has probably more of the unreleased games than we've ever put out there. I think it includes a game called Blowout, which I don't think we've ever put on any of our collections. Some of the things, the iPhone and iPad games right now, there's only six of those.
Yes, I think
there's only six of those right now on the iPhone and the iPad games, but there are more of them coming out. And the same thing with the Game Room. I think they've released about 20 of them so far, but more of those are coming out.
Okay.
But on the Intellivision Lives collections, we try to rather than try to milk it and say, okay, we're going to do volume one, volume two, volume three, or something like that.
Yeah.
We just put out everything we legally can put out.
Okay.
And we did do one called Intellivision Rocks a few years ago. But that was made up of the games that Activision and iMagic did for Intellivision.
Oh, okay.
Because we bought the rights for those.
Okay, so you ended up getting them.
Yes. But usually if you get an Intellivision Lives collection, you're getting all the games or almost all the games that we can legally include on
That's
the collection.
It. That was the question I was going to say. I know there's 125 of them, but this is the legally allowed amount that you're allowed to use and send out.
Yeah, for the ones that we own. Because like I said, the 125, you're also including iMagic did 14 games, Activision did 7, Sega did 1, Parker Brothers did 5 or 6.
Yes.
So we can't include those, and we can't include the licensed games like the Tron games, the Data East arcade games, which was Burger Time, Lock and Chase, Bump and Jump, so we can't include those, and the Konami games, Pole Position and Locomotion.
Yeah.
But yeah, the games that we have full legal title to,
yes,
about 60 games, that's what you're going to get on the collections.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Now, for totally a technical reason, horse racing is not on the DS version. It's
okay.
on the console versions.
Okay.
So occasionally there'll be something like that for some bizarre reason is missing. But essentially you're going to be getting all of our games.
Okay, good, good. And I know you just, before briefly, you were talking about the Xbox Arcade Games Room. That was something that really got me excited when it first came out, because I couldn't wait to get in and jump in and play. How was that project? Like, how did you get involved in that project? Like, and are you guys still involved in that? And when you release the titles,
yeah,
and basically like that, you still get the rights and, you know, a bit of money on the side as well. So basically, how was that? Did they come? You guys come into it yourselves, or did they approach you, or how did that work?
Well, they did approach us. Well, what happened is that first, on the 360, on the Xbox Live, they went to the company Crave that released our Xbox version, and
oh, yeah,
said, "Hey, you know that version you did, that was really nice, and we think that's going to have kind of a perennial cult following. Can we put that into our Xbox Originals?"
Okay.
And that's something which is there on the internet that you. That for, I think it's $15, however many points it is, you
yeah.
download the entire image of our Xbox 360 and television list. You get all the games,
yeah,
and you can play them on your Xbox 360.
Sure.
And that was really cool. And that was something that they talked to Crave about, and so we made a deal through them. Now, then, though, a little bit later, and this came together, everybody makes fun of Microsoft sometimes. Like, oh, you're a huge company. But I tell you, they have been the easiest company we've ever worked with.
That's
they
good.
Just have been so good on this. They approached us and said, and at the time it was all very top secret. And they said,
yeah,
we got this thing, and we can't tell you, you know, the name of it and everything, but it's going to be this thing where we're going to try to get the rights to like every game that's ever been released in the world. And put it into this game room.
Yep.
And we need to include television.
Yes.
Would you like to do that? And I said, yeah, sure, you bet. And that deal came together so quickly. And yes, it's a deal where we get a royalty on the games and everything. And they every couple of months they send me, you know, could you please approve the graphics and the look and the gameplay for this game and that game? And they just include some more. And I'm not allowed to say which games are coming up and which games we've recently looked at and everything. But,
yeah.
And I've lost count now of how many there are. I mean, they've launched, I think they launched with 13. We were in the initial launch in April, I think it was, in March or April. And they had 13 of our games. And I think there are like 20 of them now, or a little bit more.
Yeah.
The idea that which they announced at CES, I guess is when they actually introduced it, was at CES in January.
Yeah.
Is that they plan to have like 3,000 games on this thing over the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's right. That's from what I've heard as well. But that's brilliant. And it's good to see that at least,
oh, yeah,
you know, it's probably every couple of months at least you'll get a few more in television games come up and people can continue playing them.
Yeah, we had set up Subhunt when we were in Las Vegas for the Classic Gaming Expo. We had it set up so people could play Subhunt in the booth.
Oh, that's good.
And it's just wonderful. It's just, again, it goes back to the original thing. Like I say, you know, this is a labor of love. All of us who are involved in this, we all worked at Mattel back in the days, and we just want to see these games being played. We want to see, you know, we want our kids to be able to say, "Hey, there's the games we did." All
that's brilliant.
And pointed at when they're playing with each other. So that's what it's really about. And so when we can go and say, "Hey, look, you know, here's a collection of everything," and not just our games, but the other games were out there at the time. To actually have something like Game Room, where you're having a collection of arcade games and home games and everything, and here's the museum of what all of them were, and then we can put out who did them and all of that. It's just, you know, it's just great. I mean, it's usually about a generation when a new technology is invented before they start coming up with, you know, like with motion pictures, when they come up with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences,
yeah,
or they start coming out with these things. And same thing with this. It's like, it took about a generation, and then people started saying, you know, who started this? Who did these first games? This is something now that this isn't a fad. This isn't a flash in the pan thing. This is something that, you know, is a new art form, a new thing that people are going to be playing and creating games for, you know, the next few centuries. And, you know, we were there at the beginning of this one.
That's brilliant.
And so it's kind of exciting to have it kind of like, before it disappears, before, you know, there's some of these unreleased games, you know, literally some of the programmers I talked to pulled them out from under their bed, and they were on EPROMs. Had this, you know, gone on
a
few more years, these games, bit rot, may have been lost forever.
Man, yeah, so that's true. That's very true.
So some of the unreleased games and stuff we have, like, those may never have been seen if we'd not been able to do this.
That's amazing. Yeah, and you can transfer them and keep them safe now.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
From generations now will know who started all this stuff and who did it.
That's awesome. Now, I know you briefly touched on a little bit on the iPhone and the Apple, the Apple products, which is a really good move as well. I've got the Intellivision version on the iPhone as well. But basically, give us a rundown of people who have the iPhone and iPad, how that works, because I know that you can't put. Well, I'm not sure if you've got all 60 games on there and if they're free or not. So how does that work on that?
Well, right now on the iPhone, I mean, we just kind of started this. We made a deal with VH1 television here. So,
yes, you know, that's right, MTV. MTV, yeah.
Okay, right. They licensed it because VH1 is kind of more their classics channel, and they were having great luck with doing things from the 1980s. And so they actually had – they first put About Intellivision on one of their shows, I Love the 80s, and then they started doing stuff like they actually put some of our games into a online thing that you could play and all that. And so then they said, well, let's put it onto the iPhone, and that came out. So they produced it. And so far they've only released 6 games, so I'm hoping that they'll be doing more. I mean, I'm hoping that within a couple of years we'll have all of them on there too.
Yeah.
But right now the way they've done it is that you download – it's actually in the App Store. It's called VH1 Classic Presents – television for iPhone.
Yes, correct.
If you search on television, you'll find it.
It'll still come up, yeah.
Yes, you don't have to actually type in VH1 Classic Presents, but you'll find it. Anyway, the app is for free, and it comes with Astro Smash, which, like I say, was a million-selling game and is one of my favorites because it's very simple.
It is.
And it's just that mindless game where you sit there and blow stuff up.
Yeah, exactly. I was doing that last night, so that you was just to get in the mood. And I was going for about half an hour and I couldn't stop.
Right. Anyway, then it's got but it's got a menu of like 6 games total. Like I say, Astro Smash is free,
yeah.
And then the other ones it shows you that Night Stalker's there, Thin Ice is there, Thunder Castle, skiing, and you just golf. You just click on one of those and it says, well, do you want to purchase that one? And I don't know how the pricing works all around the world, but it's 99 cents here, plus a dollar.
Yeah, and, about $1.19 in Australia as well. So, yeah, 99 cents to roughly around that time. Okay, so it pretty much works like a DLC option within the game. You get it. If you like it, you buy it, and it starts up.
Right. Yeah, so you get the first one for free, and then, you know, you get each additional one for, you know, around that $1 price. So it's, you click it right then, it downloads it for you.
Yeah.
The iPad is a little bit different because it's got a flat fee of like $4, $5,
yes,
whatever, and you get 6 games total come with
okay.
it. So you don't get anything for free on the iPad. You have to pay up front. You have to pay the $4, but you wind up with 6 games.
Okay. And then...
and like I say, more. I don't know whether they're going to do more through the same thing, or you have to. Or there'll be a separate app, or how it'll work exactly, because that's all, you know, because VH1 licensed it. That's all their decision on how best to market it. And I know that with the iPhone and iPad stuff, people are still trying to figure out exactly the best way to market stuff on that.
Yeah.
Initially, they were going to do it one way. They were going to do a subscription. It was going to cost this. It was going to cost that.
Yeah.
But then as things have come out, they say, oh, that system doesn't work, and this doesn't work. So they're still trying to figure out the marketing on that. But
that's fair
my hope is within a couple of years, you'll be able to get the iPad and the iPhone. And the nice thing about that is that because of once you buy it, as we make improvements or something like that, you get those for free.
That's true.
So, like, we just came out with a better way to handle the disc.
Yes.
The guys that did it have come up with a brilliant new way. It's just a totally intuitive thing with the disc now, that just wherever you touch it, it just recalibrates it that, oh, okay, that's where the disc is. And then
you
move your hand anyplace else, it just automatically says, oh, okay. So if you just pick up the iPhone version now and you want to play Astro Smash where you're pushing left and right on the disc,
yes,
you can push anywhere on the screen. And then when you press anyplace else, it says, oh, that must have been the left, this must be the right. Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you press them right, it says, oh, this is the new left, oh, okay. And so it just very intuitively knows where you are. So
that's brilliant.
We're going to be uploading that pretty shortly. So the constantly, you know, will be the updates, and we're always going to be making it better, because like I said, again, it's a labor of love, and the company that's actually doing the development on that is headed by Bill Fisher, who was one of the guys at Mattel who did the games Space Spartans and B-17 Bombers.
That's awesome.
We try whenever possible. You know, I heavily, it was VH1's decision, but I heavily said, you know, if you really want this done right, you should hire Quicksilver Software, because the president of it is Bill Fisher, who will go out of his way to make sure it's done correctly.
Oh, that's brilliant.
When we did the Crave games, I said, hey, you know, you guys really should use real-time associates, because the president of that company, Dave Warhol, was the guy who at Mattel who did the game Thunder Castle and Mindstrike. So we've tried whenever possible to get involved the former programmers, because so many of them are still involved in video game production.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it.
I think that we probably have the highest percentage of people still in the industry of the people who worked at Mattel. I think that and part of the reason for that is that when we hired people at Mattel, and I know this because I was involved in hiring a lot of them, we didn't look for, oh, gee, who's the best programmer? We looked for creative people who knew how to program.
Okay.
So Dave was a musical person. We've had musicians and dancers and artists and everything who became programmers, who learned something about programming and have since become great programmers. But we hired some good programmers because you need people who can do a lot of the technical work and a lot of stuff, but we really looked for a creative team. And I think as a result of that, a lot of them always looked for how to stay in gaming, whether it was computer games or video games, after the crash of 1983.
Yeah.
So there's still so many of them that if I needed to really put together a great team of programmers,
you can get them all back.
Yeah.
You know what?
That's my
next question. Now this one's going to come out from the side. I'm going to hit you from the side on this one. Do you think you'll have any plans to bring out a next generation title, like full on 3D graphics, just remake of probably one of the best games that you've ever made into like a AAA title? You think?
It's something we've talked about for quite a while now. And under various different kind of scenarios. We want to be very careful of it, because there's been some games, like they came out with an Asteroids game a few years ago,
yes,
that I looked at and said, gee, this doesn't feel anything like the original Asteroids.
Yes.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's a great new game and everything, but it doesn't have just kind of that quick, you know, shooting up sort of stuff. So if we did something, we've talked about, well, we wouldn't want to go overboard.
Right.
But we would want to, yeah, we could put some new graphics in, we could put some new levels in and everything. There was some of that stuff we wanted to do back at Mattel. I remember the guy who did the game Night Stalker.
Yeah.
As a joke, he proposed a game. The title of it is a joke, but he proposed a game called Ms. Night Stalker that would have a scrolling maze. It would have multiple mazes. It would have some things where you can blow up and go through walls and stuff. And it was all stuff that could have been doable back then.
Yes.
But it would have had the same feeling of the original game, but just with some new features and things. So
we looked
at that. We've had there's an Asteroids upgrade that we've thought of, and Night Stalker upgrades and stuff. And yes, we would like to do that. Now, one of the problems that we do have now is that unlike what we were years ago, where there's a bunch of 20-year-olds, hey, let's do that, we're now like, gee, we're in our 50s, and we have families and mortgages and things. And so you can't just say, hey, I'm going to create this new game like some people can do.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing we're competing with now. We're competing with now, you know, 20-somethings or even, you know, people who are 17 or 18 who are going to, oh, yeah, I'm going to create this game. And, yeah, I'm not going to get paid for it, and I'm going to spend 6 months doing nothing else but that.
Yeah.
We can't do that anymore.
you know what you should do? You should...
we
hire him and bring him over.
We need the capital and everything to really do the stuff we want to do. So every time that we have a success, I mean, now this is great. Now that we have the DS out, we can look at, because again, it's a labor of love. We're not looking just to get rich. We're looking at, oh, great, this is going to bring in some money. What can we do now? What can we generate now? The DS version literally came about, and this is kind of a thing that people forget about. When the DS first came out, It was introduced, like, I think in 2003, at the same show that Sony introduced the PSP.
Oh, okay.
And the word was that the DS was going to be available that Christmas, and then the PSP would be available the following year. So it was going to be a next Christmas product.
Yes.
And the word was, back in 2003 or 2004, whenever they introduced it, was that, well, the DS will probably have one good Christmas, and then it will be wiped out by the PSP.
You're right.
So no one believed in the DS. Now, I saw the DS, and because of that screen and because of the ability to bring up the overlay, I said, that's the perfect platform for the Intellivision.
It is.
I want our game to be on the Intellivision. And we went around to the publishers, and they all said, the DS isn't going to be around. We'll talk to you about doing a PSP version. The PSP didn't have enough buttons. How are we going to do that? It's like we thought of some different scenarios, but we couldn't come up with a really great way to do it on the PSP, and I kept saying, we've got to do it on the DS. So we took the money and did it ourselves.
Brilliant. That's a good idea.
We paid for the development of it. So, yes, when we have successes on it, we were able to do that because the plug-and-play unit sold nearly 4 million copies, so we were a little cash-rich at the time, so we were able to say,
spend it up. That's right.
But the thing is, it finally took like 6 years to get a publisher to finally release the thing.
Wow.
So it's been cash tight, so we haven't been able to like really develop new things. Now that it's out there, and I hope everybody hearing this goes out and buys. Yes.
Yes, I agree.
Not only will we have a great time, not only have a fun time on it and everything, it's a great value and it's great games, but also it'll help us then do the next stuff we want to do. And that has been something, especially on something like Xbox Live Arcade. That's something we've been talking about a lot, is that would be a great place to do some of these games.
I think so.
An improved, an updated version, and then, but still it would be small, because it would still be a kind of, a midway between the classic fast game and then, you know, really spectacular graphics and everything.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there that it would be a game that you could download and play on that. So I think Xbox Live Arcade may be the place we want to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe in the future some DSi games, something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Where, you know, where that's where it is. The thing is, each one of those, you know, I'm just throwing out numbers here totally.
Yeah.
But, you know, those games, the budgets of those games have got to be, you know, starting in the $50,000 range or something like that to get it done. So you need a little cash flow to get it going. You need some background on that. Again, unless you're a 16-year-old guy working in your garage, just like, hey, this is fun, which is great. I wish I could do that now.
Yeah.
I never had a chance to do that back then because I came to this when I was in my mid-20s.
Okay.
You know, I would have loved if in high school or something like that, boy, we actually had the opportunity. We did some of that with computer games when I was in college.
Yes.
We had access to the first, I think we actually, in our computer club, we actually had one of those build-it-yourself Apple I computers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As I recall.
Yeah.
We certainly had a lot of little kit computers in our computer club in college, and I think I programmed Blackjack on most of them. Because I've always looked at the computers and said, hey, what games can we do? What fun can we do?
Yeah.
Which is why I went into special effects and film special effects back then. Was how can we use computers to do special effects for film? Because that was just starting back then.
All right, okay, that's brilliant. So tell me something. Where do you think the gaming industry is going to be going in the next 5 to 10 years? And where do you see yourself and the Intellivision Lives fit into that? I got to give
well,
you that.
Well, on the one hand, the one thing where you're talking about, oh, gee, we'd like, you know, some new games and so. That's one thing that I really would like to do because, you know, it's like, I love that we've got these games out there and getting the games out there, but, you know, we're taking the same 60 games and going out there. Mm. Now, on the DS, it's, like, wonderful, and I think that as we get these games all onto the iPad, that's also touch-sensitive, is just great. But, yes, at some point, you do want to say, gee, it'd be, you know, where's the challenge of, can we go with something a little bit different, a little bit new? So I think that that is something you'll see from Intellivision, is either totally new games.
Oh, brilliant. That's right. That's what we'll, that's what we're hopefully trying to see what we can get out, like, say, totally new game made by Intellivision.
Right, yeah, and but always keeping in mind that where we came from, so trying to keep that kind of feel. Yeah, the, I'm not sure who first said it. Nolan Bushnell is credited with it. Everybody kind of says it back then, is the games were easy to learn, difficult to master.
Yes.
And I think that today some of the games are maybe, you know, I don't think that we would want to do an Intellivision game that is an epic game where you have to keep saving it and starting it up again and play for 40 hours or something like that.
I think the idea would be that. You should. That's great. You could bring up an RPG.
Okay.
You could bring out your Minotaur or the Dungeons and Dragons version.
That's true. I mean,
I'd buy that.
You know, even I forget that sometimes. I forget sometimes that, you know, the thing about Intellivision was we did have games like that. We did have games like Minotaur, the Treasures of Tarman, that were really great strategy games and were really very complicated. I mean, compared to the games that were on Atari or other, even computer games at the time, we had some games that were very sophisticated, lengthy games. And it would have been nice to have saving in those games and everything. So, so yeah, I shouldn't say that. But still, there's just a sense of a type of game that we did back then that I want to make sure we never lose that as we go to new games. I can see us doing new casual games, certainly, with the Intellivision brand on them. You know, this has been something we've talked about for quite a while, is where do we go with the Intellivision thing. But yeah, I would love to expand into designing new games and doing sequels to some of the games. And,
yeah, that'd be fantastic.
I would, like I say, like we were saying earlier, we wanted to do some of this back in the 1980s, is do Night Stalker, but with different mazes. Do Astro Smash, but with maybe a 2.5 3D view, like Zaxxon, where you're looking down sideways, so that you can not only move back and forth, but also, you know, not a completely 3D thing, but something that's likely to be on a grid that you can move around on. So there's been a number of things like that where we've looked at and said, yeah, we could do sequels to these games and come up with new ones like that. But yeah, I mean, some of these games, like for example, Utopia, could probably be turned into one of these epic games.
Yeah.
You know, you could really do something spectacular with that. And there's just genres of games back then that we wanted to do that we just never got around to. I mean, I remember Mark Urbanek and I, we so much wanted to do a pirate game on Intellivision. I mean,
well, there you go.
I remember it was when we were trying to come up with the Intellivoice ideas. And we came with this pirate idea, and for like the next week, Mark Urbanek was walking around going, "Arr, arr!" He wanted to do a game with a pirate where the parrot on your shoulder would be giving you information. Be quiet, please.
That'll work now.
Oh yeah, the Intellivoice pirate game was something that he, you know, it's like there's still some games that we never really got to do. That in fact, it's very funny that when Bill Fisher started his own company, Quicksilver, he bought the idea library because our vice president kept a little note card thing where if people came up with an idea for a game, they would say, "Hey Gabriel, I got this idea for a game."
He'd write it down,
and there was like 100 ideas for games that never got done.
And
it's just a little portfolio, and Bill occasionally will dip into it for ideas and stuff. And we've actually thought of the idea. It's like, hey, Bill, you know, we should really do that and put some Intellivision names on those, and we could actually say they really truly were from the files of the Blue Sky Rangers.
It's true, though.
Really, this was a game that really somebody back in 1981 came up with, hey, this would be a great Intellivision game, and let's do it now.
Awesome.
So, yeah, there's plenty we would love to be able to do and that I hope we'd be able to do. And it really comes down to the point now of capital and cash flow and everything more than anything.
That's true.
But if somebody, you know, would like to come along and say, "Hey, I'll invest $30 million in Intellivision," yeah, we'll do all sorts of fun things.
That's fantastic.
I think we've shown too that this has gone on for over 10 years. It's not just there really is an interest. There really is a market out there for these games.
There really is, and
sometimes the problem is we get a roadblock from some people. It's like, when we were trying to come out with the this DS version,
yep.
I was like every week going to another company and talking to them. And what I discovered after very quickly was that a lot of these companies today are run by people who grew up with these games, and they wanted to meet me.
Yeah,
they
that's
wanted
right.
To meet an Intellivision guy.
That's
and they
awesome.
Wanted to talk in television and sit around and talk. But then when it actually came to, can we buy the game? It turns out these companies were all financed by like Japanese corporations and stuff, and their marketing people look at it and say, oh, we just don't see, no, we don't quite see doing it and everything.
Yeah.
Because a lot of companies today,
they
look at the game and say, is it going to sell a million copies?
Mm.
Well, I got to say, frankly, we're not going to sell a million in television copies.
Mm.
Now, I mean, we did on the plug and plays, but all of the marketing would say, oh, yeah, well, that's a toy. If you get that onto the end shelf at Walmart, then people are going to come in, but they're not going to do it on a video game.
Yeah.
But we can probably, you know, we've shown we can sell 300,000 of these games.
Yeah.
But for a lot of companies, 300,000 isn't good enough.
Yeah.
You know,
that's very sad.
Electronic Arts, their overhead is like, well, we can't go with a game. They would rather go with a game that might be a flop and might only sell 20,000, but it has the potential of selling a million, rather than go with a game like us that everybody agrees, everybody in the marketplace says, now it's going to do between $200,000 and $300,000.
Mm.
$200,000 to $300,000 units.
Yeah.
They, you know, of course, our marketing, our company is built on the idea that, you know, there is a niche out there and these people would like these games, and these people deserve to have those games.
Exactly.
There are people who grew up with Intellivision, they want to play these games, and we're going to do everything possible to get them out there. I mean, the other thing is, in terms of the future, and I've mentioned it several times in the past, there are these games, the Tron games, the Burger Time, and the arcade games and those, and we never give up on those. We're always looking at, is there a way we can do that? Is there a way we can put it together?
Yeah.
With the new Tron movie coming out, we were talking to the people there, and it's like, well, they were too busy on other stuff, but possibly when the Blu-ray comes out, or possibly, I mean, I'm hoping for a sequel to the new Tron, so.
Ah, even the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray would be a great idea, having the game on the Blu-ray, and people can play it on the TV.
Yeah, or the thing is, see, we have those games that you can play them on your PC.
Exactly.
So we said, hey, why not just do, I said, we will give you for free these games, and you can put them on your site and point to our site and everything, and we'll just do a mutual publicity thing.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of ways we can do it, and I'm hoping that, you know, our goal is we want to put these games in the hands of the programmers. The money is just so that we can go to new platforms and new ways of doing it and create maybe something new. But the ultimate goal is that the people who play these games can play them again.
Exactly, and that's it. So tell me one thing. This is going to be probably one of your last questions I'm going to ask you. I've asked you too many.
And then you finally shove it. I warned you at the beginning. I will talk in television and classic video games all day long.
Oh, I'm not bored. You can keep on talking my ear off all night long. I don't care, because I love the games, and video games are our passion here at Capsule Computer, so you know that we could talk all day and night. But my last question, let's say we'll make this one our last question. What do you enjoy most about working with your team over there at Intellivision Productions?
I think I mentioned earlier what a creative team it is. It's just fun. It's just fun. I remember, and this came about, when it looked like Intellivision, Mattel Electronics was going to get out of the business, I remember having a conversation with Mark Urbanek, the pirate guy. and he was just really upset knowing that it looks like we were going to go out of business. He's like, oh, man, he says, I just know I'll never work at any place as fun as this again. And I said, oh, sure, but it'll be a place that we create.
Yes.
And that's what, you know, if you're not having fun doing what you're doing, you shouldn't be doing it. In fact, this comes on to George Plimpton. George Plimpton was the guy who did the commercials in the United States for Intellivision.
Okay.
And he was, I don't know if you remember George Plimpton at all, but he was a guy who actually came into money. He was born into money. His father was an ambassador. He was the editor of the Paris Review magazine. He knew everybody, the literary scene, and he was also a sports writer. So that's why we hired him, is because we wanted somebody who knew sports and could say, hey, our sports games are more realistic.
Oh, okay.
But this guy was, but so he was a, is a literary guy, a driven guy. But one of his quotes, but he was always, he was doing stuff, and he loved fireworks, and he was always out doing something. He acted in some movies and all sorts of things.
Okay.
And he said one time, he said, "I've never believed there was anything intrinsically wrong in having fun."
That's right.
And I'm really glad that that was our spokesman, because that's kind of our philosophy, is if you're not having fun, don't do it.
Mm.
And that's just so that's why I still like doing this, because, like, tomorrow I'm going to be going and seeing Steve Roney, who's the co-founder of Intellivision with me.
He's a friend of mine.
He was one of the programmers back. He did B-17 Bomber, and he did Space Spartans.
Okay.
He worked with Bill Fisher then. He works with Bill Fisher now.
Oh, awesome.
He is our senior VP of software development in Intellivision. He developed the Macintosh emulator, which has been the basis for all the emulators we've used since then.
Oh, okay.
When we do the Nintendo DS version, the programmers get working on that. They start off with
the base.
And I'm seeing him tomorrow, because these are just people I've known for 30 years, and they're friends of mine, and that's what I like. I just like the social part of it, that we get together and we, you know, come up with ideas and we work on it, but we're all friends.
That's brilliant.
So that's the thing, is that Mattel, the real days of Mattel lasted for just over 2 years.
Yes.
But 30 years later, I'm still friends with all these people.
That's amazing.
And when we go to a show in Vegas, I think 10 or 12 of them showed up just to do a panel discussion there. And, we're probably going to be doing, I'm hoping we're going to be doing a few signings in Los Angeles at places where people can come and buy the DS version and just have all the Blue Sky Rangers just show up and just, you know, have lunch and talk, and then go on over to GameStop or wherever and sign copies of it. And that's what I'm looking forward to. That's why I like it more. It's just for me, it's kind of the social thing of sitting around and telling the stories, and not only the old days, but what people are doing today.
Exactly.
Like I say, so many of them are still in the game industry, and so many of them are still working on fascinating things. Like I say, Dave Warhol, Don Daglow is a consultant for a number of places, including there's a museum back east here that is doing video games now.
Oh.
He's a consultant for them. Just talking about what's going on in the industry still, it's just fun. It's just I just have fun. That's what
the passion and the fun. That's basically all you talk. That's basically
yep.
what it is.
Yep.
That's awesome. Well, Keith, thank you very, very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. As I say, I just love talking this stuff.
That's fantastic. Now, like I said, we will have links off to your website and everything from this interview here on capsulecomputers.com. Everybody who's watching it, get yourself Intellivision Lives now on. If you got it on DS, get it on that. Xbox on that. Get play on the games room. Or you got an iPhone, get it on that. I don't know. Just get it on anything so you can take it with you anywhere you go. Is that right?
Yes, indeed.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Keith. We appreciate all the time.
Thank you.
And we'll speak to you
like
soon.
Put me on speed dial and call me anytime you want.
I will. Don't you worry.
Thank you very much. Somebody cancels. Call me up. I'll talk to television with you.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks very much for your time, mate.
You bet. Bye-bye.